Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Good morning. I'm Dave Kubikin.
And good morning. I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
And Jane Marie and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm, and we're here every single weekend to hear your questions and talk to each other about estate planning and elder law, wills, trusts, Medicaid, getting older, having grandkids, everything you could think of, plus some other things that you may not think of. And the key is we can take your questions if you dare call us at 518-476-5900. We have offices in Albany, Kingston, Saratoga, and Clifton Park. Jane Marie, we were just talking before we got on. Ben said it was about 41 degrees when he was coming in. What's it looking like in the Berkshires?
Oh, it's about the same here. It maybe went up a degree or two since then.
How you doing? What's going on?
I learned something important this morning.
Oh, what's that?
I know your middle name, so if you're, like, doing something and you're in trouble, I can use your middle name.
Yes. We don't need to talk about my middle name because if you know my middle name, you'll know all my internet passwords. So let's just keep it between us three, okay, Ben?
I'm good with that, yes.
Okay, yeah. I'm not going to tell you the street I grew up on either, Jane Marie. Nice try.
Are your first
pet name? Yeah, not happening.
Was it Fluffy? Was it, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have one piece of the puzzle down. I'm going to work on the other.
Yeah. There you go.
That's right.
So, Jane Marie, a lot going on. It's now fall. Well, it's not actually fall literally, but it's, you know, it's fall. It's 41 degrees outside, right? It's fall.
Oh, no, it's still summer. Summer is my favorite season, so I won't give it up. It's still summer until September 22nd. So let's not rush things, you know?
It is beautiful out, though. I hope everyone's enjoying themselves and staying safe and getting outside when you can.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie, in the office, it's been like, for me at least, it's been super busy in a way that I can't remember it being like this. I've had so many Medicaid-type clients and conversations, and then I've had so many something's going wrong with people's estates conversations and estate administration and my brother's not telling me what's happening, and et cetera, et cetera. And maybe the in-between I'm not seeing as much of, but something just switched. And I know I could explain the Medicaid because, you know, all the changes that are coming up in October and then later on this fall, like that all makes sense. The state administration stuff, it's been bizarre. And I was hoping that, you know, since you tend to do a few more of those than I do, so we could talk to people about the ills of probate a little bit today.
Yes, we've been so busy on that side, and not just busy, you know, handling estates, but handling disputes in estates. Seems like everyone these days is some dispute between the children and the family members. And really, the best way to try and avoid those disputes is to, well, to stay out of probate, you can do a trust. But I'm talking about more specifically as to who gets what assets is to write that down, figure it out ahead of time, not leave it up to your executor to decide those things. A lot of the disputes are when things aren't clearly stated. A lot of time it happens with personal possessions, right? One child wants one thing, another child wants the same thing, and they're going to disagree over who gets it. So those things are pretty difficult to work out in court. But in general, anytime you have to go to court, it's going to be expensive and it's going to take a lot of time. So that's why doing a trust is the best way to avoid all of these disputes.
For most, absolutely. And, you know, it's we're at the level of estate planning, I think, and I think there are other firms that are like this, where the end result of who gets what, if you have documents, right, good documents, for them, chances are that's a foregone conclusion, right? If you want one kid to get it all and the other kid to not get anything, as an example, an extreme example, with well-worded estate plans, we'll get there, right? Maybe we'll go through this thing called probate that we're about to talk about. maybe there's some biting and some hurt feelings. But if the documents were done well and the person who created that plan, mom, dad, had their wits about them, that result's going to happen for the most part, right? Obviously, you know, litigation, who knows? But we're pretty comfortable. How we get there, that's the whole thing. I mean, it could be the worst several years of people's lives if they're going through a litigation in court. We never want to voluntarily go through court to get something as simple as an estate plan done. And when you open your plan to probate, when you, you know, say, well, this, they all know what I want to do with my paintings. No, they don't. Maybe they don't. And the less you detail, the less you plan, you're setting up these fights that are just really awful fights to have. I don't think there's any other way to do it. You know, I've dabbled with divorces, Jamie, and I can tell you the clients who are the, I don't want to say angriest, but just down in the dumps the most aren't even that. It's people going through a hell called an estate contest or a fight in court over you know, mom or dad's stuff. It's pretty bad.
It is. It sometimes you see it, you know, break up families, you know, siblings like aren't going to talk to each other, you know, after they go through this process, or it may take a while before they are able to get past that. So I have been involved in a lot of will contests right now. And as I tell my clients, you know, it's very rare that you win a will contest, but it doesn't mean that your siblings can't put you through it. So when you go through a will contest, the other side is allowed to interview the witnesses to the will to see if the person had capacity, right? They're going to look at their medical records. They're going to look at, you know, were they being influenced? They're entitled to ask all of those questions.
Sorry to cut you off for a second because you're giving everyone the steak right now. Mm-hmm. We got to save the steak in a little bit, okay? We got to give them some salad right now, okay? When someone passes away, okay, the real basics right now, someone passes away, they own stuff, and that stuff is going to go somewhere. And if they have a will, the will will say how these things go. If they don't have a will, there's a statute in New York that says how things are going to go. It's called dying intestate if you die without a will. And before we can talk about what either of those two things mean, we also need to know, well, did you own anything as husband and wife? Did you own anything with other people's names, with some sort of rights of survivorship, or did you have an asset with a beneficiary? Because those things actually go outside of those documents you've created, right? So, Jamie, you have life insurance, and you have your husband, Michael, as a beneficiary. He's not going to get that money if you passed away because your will says he gets that money. He's getting it because that life insurance policy says Michael, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you're going through probate, it's only for the assets that you own individually in your own name. So sometimes people haven't put assets in joint name, or sometimes they have an asset where you can name a beneficiary, but they name a beneficiary who's deceased. That asset now has to go to your estate. There's lots of ways where things can come into probate. If you don't have assets in a trust, it's going to go through probate. But you're right. If you do have assets with joint name or beneficiaries on it, that is a good way to avoid probate. You know, that can't be contested when you have a beneficiary on it.
Right. Now, there's another group of negatives that can come with that. Normally, right, we want to avoid probate wherever we can. But the most important thing isn't avoiding probate. The most important thing is that the right people get the money at the right time, right? Right ages, and your plan happens. And so, you know, we do these things as attorneys, especially in this area of law, Jeremy, where we're talking kind of on both sides of our mouth. And we say things like, you want to avoid probate, but you don't want to avoid probate in that way. You want to avoid probate in this way. Well, what do you mean? If I'm avoiding probate, that's a good thing, right? Well, let me give you an example, right? my two kids are a little younger than your two kids, Jeremy. Right, I'm at 7 and 1.
What are you right, at? A little bit younger.
Mm-hmm. What are you at? 21 and 19.
18 and soon to be 21. Yeah. So legally, both of my kids
are adults. He'll finally be able to have his first sip of alcohol.
He's turning 21 in, let's see, about 3 weeks.
Oh,
so
very cool.
Yeah, he's looking forward to going out and ordering a drink like all 21-year-olds are. But
David, who is that cool for? I'd like to find that out. And when your kids get to be 21, I'd like to oppose that same thing to you.
So who because, it's cool for?
Yeah.
It's cool for the proprietors of bars and restaurants who are going to make more money now. That's what it's cool for.
Oh, okay.
Not cool for the parents who are worrying about
exactly.
driving home, right?
Not cool. Yeah, that's not
spoken like someone that has a 7 and a 1-year-old.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking you get to sleep at night for a little while.
Yeah, exactly.
So, by the way, I almost overslept this morning because I was up from like 4 to 5:30, and then I went back to bed, and then woke up, and it was 7:45. So anyway,
I'm a 7-year-old
and a 1-year-old. Okay, and Jamrie, you would think that I want all my money, right, that my wife and I will accumulate over our lives to go to each other and then to the kids.
Right.
Makes sense. And so many people that I know, and I'm sure that you know, especially when your kids were younger, so your friends, would mm-hmm. also have the same sentiment. They want their money to go to their kids. That's their plan. And they could avoid probate, right? They just have life insurance that says everything to the spouse. And then the backup, right. Who? The kids. Because we want to avoid probate. Jamrie keeps hammering that in. Avoid probate. Avoid probate. Well, mm-hmm. in my situation, if something happened to Isabel and I, all of a sudden I have a 7-year-old and 1-year-old who get a lot of money because they're the beneficiary of my policy. And my plan isn't to give money to my kids. My plan is to give money to my kids at certain ages when it's mm-hmm. appropriate, when they're going to, you know, so they can go to school and et cetera. And so it's not just avoid probate. The first step is a good plan, which is whatever our clients decide. Who gets what? When do they get it? How do they get it? So mm-hmm. those, you know, some people may sit there and say, well, you know what? Everything I own is joint with my spouse. And mm-hmm. then we have the kids as backup beneficiaries. I don't need any estate plan whatsoever. I'm already avoiding probate. And mm-hmm. yes, that's true when things are perfect. But things are rarely perfect. And more importantly, you know, are your grandkids or your kids going to get money at the right ages? And so we want you to have this good plan. Yes, it's important to know what will avoid probate. Sometimes we'll make things go through your trust, as an example, as a better way to avoid probate because that's where the rules are. Your documents have the rules. So let's say that, Jamrie, we're talking about dad, and dad's living in a house by himself. And he doesn't have a spouse anymore. When mm-hmm. he passes away, and I think you mentioned this earlier, right? There will be some sort of administration, right? Either things go based on the will, or things go if there wasn't a will. Mm-hmm. And okay. the process of taking that will from a piece of paper and turning it into the New York State recognizing it as someone's official will, that's mm-hmm. literally what probate is. So can you go into what it means to get to that point, what documents and all that stuff? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. So many people do think, okay, if I have a will, I've avoided probate, which is really the opposite of what happens. So when you have a will, you do have a document that says who you want to be your executor and who you want to be your beneficiaries. But before you can do anything, that will has to be filed with the court. Notice has to be given out to anyone who would, who would inherit the property if you didn't have a will. So
distributees.
Your distributees, right. So if you have 3 children, notice would have to be given to all 3 children. And they either have to agree to that will being probated, or they have to file an objection to that will being probated. So let's talk about the norm, right? In most of our cases is the children all agree, the will gets admitted to probate, and the court approves the appointment of the executor and gives them official letters that lets them go and do their job. That's the majority of the cases. So it's still a court process, and it still takes time, which is why you want to try and avoid it if you can. But if anyone raises an objection, that makes the whole process much, much longer and much more expensive. And that's what we have been seeing a lot of lately, for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. So let's give a couple examples. And of course, no names, or names have been changed to protect the innocent, or whatever they say on those real crime shows. So I had a phone call with a client. They are now a client, and they are two of four siblings. Okay, mm-hmm. Two of four. And not all four are full blood siblings, but they consider themselves siblings. It's kind of a moot point given the fact pattern, but it could matter in other fact patterns, whether, second marriages, kids are adopted, not adopted, it matters.
Right.
So four siblings, I'm representing two of them. The other two were up to something, it seems like, because mom's estate plan did a complete 180. It was what you would call probably, Jamie, a traditional, real basic plan. Everything goes to my four kids. Everything goes to my two kids. Guess which two it's going to, right? So that coincided with mom's health going downhill, mom's cognitive abilities going downhill, or at least she was diagnosed with dementia. That, by the way, doesn't mean that you can't talk to them anymore. Sliding scale, obviously, but she apparently was getting worse. And those two siblings were all of a sudden on the scene. They didn't have much to do with mom in, as adults, but now that she wasn't doing as well, they were around a little more. Not necessarily helping, but around a little more. And lo and behold, mom's will doesn't leave things to all four kids. It leaves things to two. And mom passed away, and my clients were given documents that said sign here to allow everything to keep going in the estate. It's called a waiver and consent. And here's a copy of mom's will where you get nothing. And so they called and said, well, what could we do? This doesn't seem right. And, the house is an asset and there's another asset here or there. And so we talked, and, we don't fish, right? You don't do any fishing trips at work. We're not looking to cause trouble where there isn't trouble already kind of evident.
Right.
And so I explained that to them, and I said, the only guarantee with these kinds of situations is that, we're going to get paid. I can't guarantee that we'll have a successful will contest for you. But I said, this is the first step. And I explained to them what you started to explain, Jamie, and I cut you off, which was the 1404 hearing, which is like a first crack, a free crack, essentially, at seeing what the facts are. So if you're going to contest a will, you have to have a reason for it. And it may be that the person who signed the will, mom, didn't have the proper mental capacity when she signed it, or she's drunk or on drugs, or she was so demented because of the dementia that she couldn't think right. She didn't know the natural objects of her bounty. She didn't know what she had. She didn't know she had four kids. Things like that, right? Son took her to some attorney who had a quickie will drawn up. That kind of thing. And, Jamie, if you get served with this waiver and consent to sign off on a will, you don't know whether that's happened or not. You have no idea. And the 1404 hearing allows, and at the cost of the estate, almost entirely, allows my clients to have me examine people who were involved in the production of the will. So I'm sorry I cut you off before about 1404s. Do you mind continuing?
Sure. So that gives your clients the opportunity to question the witnesses to the will and the attorney who drafted the will. And that gives you a chance to decide, based on that interview, whether you want to object to the will. So if you're interviewing the attorney, for example, and he, like you said, just met with the client briefly, the daughter brought in mom to sign the will, and the daughter was telling the attorney what mom wanted, and then mom just signed the will, and it all happened very quickly, that would lead you to think that either mom had dementia or she was being influenced by that child, so you may want to object to the will in that case.
Right. And, you know, things that it's not like that proceeding itself is going to determine whether the will goes through or not. It's really an opportunity for you to figure out if you're going to contest or not. Because contesting, it's essentially a hearing, a trial. It's a lot more involved.
Right.
And it could be helpful. On the other side, if we think about what we just said, right, when it's my fact pattern, oh, my God, we have to do this hearing because we really need our information.
Right.
And other fact patterns where there wasn't anything that, you know, it's all explainable, where we represented mom when she signed her will. She was with it, right? And we mm-hmm. can't believe that one of the kids is contesting her plan. The 1404s mm-hmm. are really annoying, and they're a way to meddle and cause the estate to have lots of attorney's fees, because not just one attorney, it might be two, it might be three attorneys who are examining or part of this process. And so score one for avoiding probate, because if you avoid probate, we're avoiding these possible hearings that could be a big waste of money, essentially, if there's a sibling that's always been trouble, who was rightfully given less from an estate, right? You know, and so they're going to hire an attorney and say, this is not fair, make up some things and go ahead and cause a huge delay in the estate administration. So when we talk about why people should in general want to avoid probate, you know, I say it because even when things are perfect and everyone agrees, it takes a long time. And even when everyone agrees, the filing fee is, you know, upwards of $1,000. And even when everyone agrees, you know, you got to pay J. Marie to do stuff. The problem is not everyone agrees, so you take all those costs and you add to it this 1404, or you add to it a more involved contest. Or you know what, at the end of the day, at another estate I have where the siblings are fighting over who bought the house and for how much, and whether it was fair market value, because it's not because they all want the house, it's because they all don't like each other. And so you're opening up the door when you have an estate administration, you go through this probate thing, whether or not you have a will.
Yes, and it can be a way for the siblings to cause trouble with each other, because I can think of one case that I had where the siblings definitely did not get along, did not like each other. And the siblings who contested the will, they knew the will was fine. That's what we had heard in conversations from the family. And they had told other family members that they were contesting the will just to make trouble for them and just to make them spend money and have this drawn out. So it's a spiteful way of doing this, you know. And sadly, that happens more often than not.
It does. You know, the connective tissue between siblings are their parents. And as soon as the parents are no longer with us, that tissue is connected as much. And if there are little tears that already exist, they get blown open.
Right.
And, you know, part of me, I shouldn't say this out loud, I guess, but part of me really likes 1404s. I like, you know, it's a different kind of attorney work and it's somewhat enjoyable. Mm-hmm. It's not enjoyable for my clients. It's not enjoyable for the proponent of the will, the executor, right? But it's, you know, I'm in court. How often are we in court, right? We do, not that often. So it's kind of nice and refreshing and novel, and maybe you're fighting the good fight. But I've had conversations with people where, you know, over years and years of practicing this in this area, I learn when something doesn't smell right. I learn when someone's going fishing and when they're trying to cause trouble and, you know, find, you know, polite ways to get off the phone and say this isn't a case that we can handle. But because we do so much planning, right, we're often on the other end of this as well. And so it's really not a fun area to do. Now, the things that you would look at, like, so I get to talk to the attorney who prepared the will. What is that going to accomplish? Well, based on their recollection, they could tell you, no, this son drove mom in, or mom came in on her own, right? Someone else was in the room. making sure she answers. Every time she had to answer a question, she looked over at her son. Right, there are things that could be telling.
And as an attorney from the other side, when we're having someone sign a will, if there is any potential for conflict, we will kick everyone else out of the room. And then talk to the client alone or mom or dad alone and make sure that they can tell you what they want. So that's exactly. important to do to make sure the will stands up.
Now, let's not be so negative, Jamerie. Let's say that everything's going perfect. And, oh, by the way, you could be our first caller this morning at 518-476-5900. We're being negative, Jamerie. And I think maybe you and I, the most, tend to be on the radio. Everything's going to be perfect, okay? No one's going to contest the will. All right? The will is going to be admitted into probate. It might take a month or two, but this whatever the will says, that's what's going to happen with the money, okay? Stop being so negative. And who cares? It's a couple thousand bucks of estate administration costs.
Right.
Okay, mom had plenty of money.
Okay.
Well, that's not it, right? That's the beginning of the book. That's not the end. Because now we need to actually administer the estate and or have the executor or administrator do what they're supposed to do. And that process, at minimum, guys, is 7 months from the date that the will got admitted. And New York allows everyone and you can imagine, an opportunity to become a creditor of the estate to, you know, they give a lot of time for bills to come in and the whole idea of probate is the court is now supervising the administration of this estate. So there's several times where Jimmer, you're essentially checking in with the court to let them know where things are at.
Yes, that's right. So you first have to file an inventory with the court, and that's just a list of all the assets of the estate that you know about or that you've discovered. And as time goes on, you may discover more assets and have to update that inventory with the court. But more importantly is that creditor period. So let's say you it's simple. There's only, one bank account, for example, and a house. So you take care of those. Maybe you sell the house, and now you have all this money in the estate account. There's still a seven-month period where creditors could file their claims. So you don't want to make full distributions until that seven-month period has expired. Because if a creditor files their claim and you've already distributed the money, now you're out of luck, right? You'd have to go to each beneficiary and ask them to return the money to pay the creditor. So that can be another complication that you didn't anticipate. Maybe some people needed the money sooner or they weren't planning on waiting for 7 months to get the money.
Right.
So that's another issue with probate that you can avoid with a trust, because with a trust, you can distribute those funds really at any time that you want to.
So you mentioned creditors, and it's a good time to start to talk about them. Ben, I don't know how we're doing, if you want to take a break now or keep going.
David, just because you got to that point, it seems like we have a natural break, so we will take our break right here. We'll be back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and Flatbush Road in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Good morning, I'm Dave.
And good morning, I'm Jamie Lee Schaefer.
Jamarie is on a 5-second delay. She's somewhere on the other part of the earth. Jamarie and I are two of the attorneys at Herzog Law Firm, and we've spent this first half hour talking about probate and estate administrations. And if it's helped everyone go back to sleep, fantastic. It's not the most exciting area to talk about, but I bet Jamarie it's actually made a couple people sit up in their chairs because they know what their family tree looks like and they know who potential troublemakers may be. Mm-hmm. And when you're going through probate, it's not like it's a guaranteed awful situation. You're just opening up the door to the possibility it may be awful. And, you know, we were talking, Jamarie, about just getting our foot in the door at the court and what that involves and what it involves to get a will probated. And then we started talking about the actual administration and how the estate takes a while to be administered because the courts want creditors an opportunity to make themselves known. And creditors can include, you know, credit card companies and medical expenses and final expenses. Those tend to trickle in after someone dies where there's, you know, ambulances and hospitals involved. But there's a much bigger creditor out there that certainly I'm more concerned about. I think you're more concerned about. Who is that?
And that's Medicaid, right? Having a Medicaid lien on your estate. And that is a real possibility if you've been receiving care at home paid for by Medicaid or in a nursing home paid for by Medicaid. Depending on how you set up your assets when you applied for Medicaid, they do have a potential lien against your estate. And they can put, especially against your house, that is a real risk against your house because that could be a pretty big lien, and your house is usually one of your more valuable assets. So having a lien against your house could mean that you do lose a lot of money to Medicaid when you eventually sell that house.
Right. So, you know, people who are clients of ours are going to and have Medicaid trusts and things like that are going to say, now, wait a minute. Okay.
Right.
I know I can't qualify for Medicaid unless I'm down to the $15,000 level. So the lien essentially it can't really exceed $15,000. Well,
right.
Not really, because there's so many circumstances where the house is something that's exempt just because we're going with, say, community Medicaid, care at home, which we're going to, I guess, spend the second half talking about. So, you know, dad gets lots of services for 4 years at home and then he passes away, right? That house, if we didn't get it out of his probate situation, we didn't get it out of his estate, we didn't do a trust or a life estate deed, that house is part of his estate and Medicaid's going to say, well, that house was exempt, you're right, but we're going to put a lien on your estate for whatever we've paid. And look at that. It's an $80,000 lien now, and we'll just attach it to the house. We'll attach it to your estate. And so it's, you know, terribly important to avoid probate as long as the result is still a plan that you're okay with. A long-term, you know, care plan, a plan as to who gets what, when do they get it, the basics. And, you know, we are picky. We don't want you to just avoid probate by luck or by having beneficiary designations. A lot of times, especially when mom and dad get to a certain age, we want you to do it by taking advantage of essentially a Medicaid trust.
Yeah, that's right. So that's why houses are tricky, right? Because if you see or read information, you may hear that the house is exempt when you apply for Medicaid, you know, especially community Medicaid, because if you are living in the house or your spouse is living in the house, it's an exempt asset. But you're right, that's not the end of the story because of that potential Medicaid lien that you can have. So that's why we recommend that you get the house out of your name, which is really out of probate, by putting it into a trust, which is one way to avoid probate, or doing the deed with the life estate, which is another way to avoid probate. Doing a deed with a life estate is kind of like putting a beneficiary on your house. So what you do is you do a deed transferring the house to your children, and you keep the right to live there for the rest of your life. But what that means is on your death, it's automatically in your children's name. So that's how you avoid probate there.
Right. So a lot of times, Jamie, when we're talking to clients and we're talking about their different options, and really all options are on the table. They don't have to do a trust. They don't have to do a life estate deed. They could have just a really good will and know that probate's a possibility. That's all right. That's a plan, too. We're concerned with the end results of our plans. And then, you know, if we do a will the right way, we're going to get the right end result. It's just there may not be as much money to give out, let's say, because the estate administration expenses were decent. There was a 1404 that eats into the estate. The largest threat to the value of people's inheritances and their estates from a broader term, right, who gets what in general, is going to be how much money's left because we spent so much money for long-term care expenses. And so if people on the radio, people who come in think, geez, they're always talking about trust, right? It's because everything always revolves around this, because the biggest threat to your plan is going to be, you know, you want to leave $100,000 to this great charity? Well, you need to have the $100,000 in your estate for that to happen. And the biggest threat to that is living a long time and having lots of needs during that length of time. So the Medicaid trusts make a lot of sense. And in addition to planning in advance of 5-year look-back periods that exist for nursing homes, right, forever, we would say, well, it also provides immediate benefits for home care through the community Medicaid program. And as anyone who listens to the show, you know, even once a month knows, community Medicaid is undergoing some pretty heavy-duty changes, actually in a number of weeks. Do you want to get into any of those changes?
Sure, absolutely. I'll get into those changes. But before I do that, I just want to point out, if you want to learn more detailed information about this, you can attend one of our webinars. So we have webinars every Wednesday. And this Wednesday coming up at 10 o'clock, we have Medicare versus Medicaid. So that's a popular one because Medicare and Medicaid is often confused, and we go through what the differences are and what you need to know about Medicare enrollment. And then at 2 o'clock, we have Elder Law Basics. And that is going to talk more in depth about what we're talking about now, about how to protect your assets or how to pay for long-term care. Other options that you have. And you can register for both of those on our website at www.herzoglaw.com. And you can also look at the list of webinars we have the following week, where we have a whole week of webinars every day at 2 o'clock. So just to go back to what we were talking about. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Jeremy, those webinars have been super helpful to existing clients, to prospective clients, friends of clients. It's a great opportunity to get information.
Yes, yes, it is. So to go back to the change that's coming up, as you said, for community Medicaid, up until now, we have always had the opportunity to help clients get care at home, basically immediately. You know, by immediately, I mean in a few months. But you could transfer assets to a trust or transfer them out of your name and then apply for community Medicaid without there being any look back or penalty period. But that is changing in, let's say, a little bit less than 3 weeks. On October 1st, there is a new law going into effect that puts a 2.5-year look back period on community Medicaid applications. So what that means is if you're applying for community Medicaid, if you've made any transfers in the past 2.5 years, that's going to be counted against you. You're going to have a penalty period during which time you can't receive Medicaid services. So we already kind of know how this works with nursing homes. You know, many people are familiar with the 5-year look-back period for nursing homes. But now it's going to be for community Medicaid applications. So you need to plan in advance, even to apply for care in your house. So that is a huge change from how we've been advising clients for years.
Right. So, Jamie, a bunch of people have asked me, okay, I've heard there's actually an extension of October 1st. And so we actually don't have to do certain things by October 1st. And what they're saying, everyone out there, is that New York may not implement the full 2.5-year look-back period on October 2nd. Right? There's talk that it may be several months before an application to Medicaid will look back 2.5 years in terms of logistics. Now,
so what that means then with this 2.5-year look back period,
All right, somebody has a problem there.
Yeah, someone has a problem. I don't know if it was me or David, so am I clear?
You sound okay right now.
All right, I'll keep going then.
Okay.
So what that means with the look-back period is that starting on October 1st is when the law changes. However, there's always the practicalities, right, of implementing the new law. And so Medicaid has said they're not going to enforce the new law until January 1st. So you have a little bit of a reprieve there, right, until the end of the year, if you apply for Medicaid, they won't be applying that 2.5-year look-back period. You know, and there's always a possibility that that may get extended again on January 1st. But I wouldn't, you know, count on that for very long. You know, I would still kind of act as if the new law, well, not act, it is coming into effect on October 1st so that you can plan properly. But between October 1st and the end of the year, if you apply for Medicaid, we know right now that they're not going to apply the new law. So that gives you a little bit of breathing room. But we still want to, if you are thinking of doing this, to try and get it done even before the end of the year. So that's what is important to do.
Right. I guess another way to say that, Jamie, is the only guarantees we know right now are people who would qualify as of September 30th. I'd rather be them than people who end up moving things around after September 30th, because there's no guarantee. The only thing that's on the books right now is October 1st as a deadline.
That's right.
And so that's the way we need to proceed with things and advise people. And as always, if we're not someone who needs care to begin with, it's just always a good idea to start these clocks because, you know, I don't think I'm some sort of, I'm looking at a crystal ball here and I'm some sort of wise person. The look back periods are going to go up over time. That's just how it's going to be, Jamie. You know, one day, I don't know when that day will be, but the look back period for nursing home care will be more than 5 years. I think that's going to happen.
Right.
You know, right now there's zero look back period for home care, and at some point this fall there'll be a full 2.5-year look back that they'll look at. Whether it's October 1st or later that they implement that actual change. So that's the only direction things are going in. And the plan is to keep getting older every day, guys. So in addition to the possibility we may have long-term care needs, having a trust, like a Medicaid trust, could be a really good way for you to also avoid probate, which is what we talked about the first half of the program. And so it kind of comes together quite nicely where we could essentially prepay expenses we would have had through probate. Instead, we use those expenses that we were going to have to create a trust to avoid probate. And, oh, by the way, we're eating into this look-back period, and we're starting to protect our assets.
David and Jay Marie, we have our first caller on the line. It is Rich from Wine and Skill.
Good morning. I have a quick question. I had filled out, I did a will, and I had my son as, you know, he was supposed to get everything. Now, when we did the will, he was not married. Since then, he got married and he is deceased. Now, my question is, does his name automatically come off of that, or how does that work?
Well, so when you did the will, did you put any alternates in there? And let me ask, you know, you don't know if you did. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
So you said if he was the executor, you said if he was if he's not able to be the executor, you name someone else?
Yes.
And then same thing for the beneficiaries? You name
yes.
someone else? That, okay.
Yeah, my grandchildren.
Okay, okay. So it's not absolutely necessary that you change the will because you do have those alternates in there, those backups.
Right.
So you may want to think about, so now if things would be going to your grandchildren, I would say you need to think about that. Are your grandchildren minors or are they over?
They're minors. 18? They're minors.
Right. So you would want to look at that will and see if there's any provisions in there for what happens when it goes to a minor, or even think about yourself. Would you want them to get the money at 18, or would you want it to be held for them until they're older than 18?
I think so we have it down when they're 21, I think.
Okay. So that's just something I would kind of revisit, is to look at that and see when they're going to get the money and who you would want to manage the money for them until they get to a certain age.
Right.
That's something that would involve, does that need to be updated? Because these are new facts and circumstances, right, from when you first did the will.
Right. My son's wife be entitled to anything?
No, not unless you said so in the will.
Okay. Right? All righty. Mm-hmm. All righty, I guess you answered it.
Well, so okay. I want to add one thing to what Jamarie said, if I may. And
okay.
That's kind of what we were dancing around the first 45 minutes here, excuse me, which is you may want to at some point, when you're looking at who gets what, when do they get it, do we want to look into protecting assets as well? If you have grandkids, then that means that long-term care may be something that's a little closer to you than it is to me with a 7-year-old and 1-year-old. And it's never too late to look at those things. And I also want you to keep in mind, as we kind of mentioned early this hour, which is you may own things that aren't subject to the terms of your will. It sounds like you have a great plan that grandkids get money, but not before 21.
Right.
But in addition to looking at your will, we would want you to look at your other assets to see who your beneficiaries are, because those beneficiaries, if you got, retirement account,
right,
names your son and the grandkids, that retirement money is not subject to any of the rules in the will.
Okay.
Because it's avoiding probate. And it's a double-edged sword. It's a great thing to avoid probate, but we want people to avoid probate in the right way.
Right,
where
right,
those
right.
rules that are so important for your grandkids are still applied to all of your assets.
There might be one problem that my grandchildren were adopted out.
They were adopted out. So your son was not the legal guardian for them?
No.
Okay. So there, what that would change isn't who gets your money. It's the wording that we would want to use. So,
okay.
For example, I'm not your grandchild, neither is Jamarie, but if you wanted to leave us money, you certainly could, right? You would have in your will, you would list our names.
Okay.
So if you do want to leave things to those grandkids, I would make reference to the fact that they are not your grandkids, that they are people. These are their names, and they were, you
that.
Know.
Yeah, I did
okay.
that.
Okay,
did that.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, well, thank
you, have
you
a very,
very
good
much.
Plan in place. No mm-hmm. problem. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
bye.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very important to do because we often have stepchildren for that the parents consider as their own child, right? But they've never been legally adopted. And so they are going to say, okay, I leave everything to my children. And they're thinking that that includes that child. But if that child's not adopted or not biologically your child, they wouldn't be included there.
Exactly. You know, Jamarie, it's like a sweet thing. I'm sorry. It's pretty nice and heartwarming, right? Especially when there are these second relationships and his kids are my kids are her kids type of situations. They grew up together, we treat them all the same. It's great that you treat them all the same. But I think what you're saying is New York State doesn't treat them the same. The titles matter, the details matter.
Right.
I did an article about the Brady Bunch, and estate planning, and I did some kind of heavy-duty research on it for this specific reason. And so, you know, Carol Brady and the other girls are Brady girls. Their last name's Brady, which would indicate that they were adopted
by dad. Right.
And there's no guarantee that the boys were adopted by mom. You never know, right? So these things actually matter when it comes to estate planning.
Yes, that's right, because if you assumed that all six were adopted, you know, you would be leaving money to all six, but really you could be leaving three of them out, right? So
that's right. That's right. And words matter, as we all know. So the right, words that we use in the document. There's a difference between my issue and your issue, Jane Marie, right? My issue are my kids and bloodline.
No,
your issue is yours.
You have a lot more issues than me, Dave.
Jane Marie, we're on the radio, for crying out loud. Okay. You can't say this out loud. What's the matter?
I forgot for a moment. I thought we were having a private talk.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Well, as you get into this advanced age, you sometimes forget things, Jane Marie. That's all right.
Yeah. You sound like my kids.
So, well, so Jane Marie, obviously a lot of these calls for estate issues that we talked about, and obviously there's been a lot of Medicaid applications and trying to get in before whatever the deadlines are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing anything in the way of guardianships? I know we only have a couple minutes here, but I know that's one of your specialties, and I know that our staff has been doing a lot more of them. Why do you think there's a bump in guardianships? And can you talk real briefly about what they are?
I can't quite explain why there's been an increase in them, but we have a lot of guardianships recently. And so basically a guardianship comes up when someone becomes incapacitated, but they haven't done any legal documents to prepare ahead of time. So those are the what we call advanced directives. So these are documents that appoint someone to take over if you become incapacitated, right? So that's your power of attorney and your healthcare proxy. But many, many people don't have those done. So we say it all the time, right? We say it on the radio that these are two really important documents that you should get done. But, you know, nevertheless, many people don't have it done. And I think what's been happening recently is people have been getting sick, going to the hospital, going to a nursing home, and now they're in a situation where for whatever reason they don't have these documents done, but so that means there's no one to make decisions for them, no one to handle their finances. And we have to, in that case, go to court and ask to have a guardian appointed to take care of things for that individual. And just like with probate, this is going to court. So going to court is expensive. It's timely. You want to avoid that if you can. It also gives the chance for people to kind of like probate, like contest the guardianship. You know, let's say you have three children and you've become incapacitated. And now one of your children says, I'm going to be the guardian, and they apply to the court. Well, maybe the other two kids say, oh, that person, you know, never managed money right. I should be the guardian instead. Now you have a little contest over the guardian. In the meantime, no one's able to take care of mom's affairs while she's, you know, waiting, while you're waiting to have the court decide who should be the guardian.
Right. And it makes estate administrations cute little inexpensive ordeals, because guardianships can become quite pricey.
Oh, very expensive, right. It could be prolonged. There's a lot of attorneys involved. There's not just the attorney you hire. The court appoints an attorney who's called a court evaluator, who's an independent party to investigate things. The court will often appoint an attorney for the incapacitated person to make sure their interests are represented. So that's at a minimum three attorneys, right? And then if anyone contests it, now you have four attorneys or five attorneys. So you can imagine how expensive that's going to be.
Right. And the key, just like the estate administrations, is even when it's easy, even when it's straightforward, even when it's husband being guardian for wife, even when it's sole child being guardian for dad, it's still expensive because the court goes through all those same steps. They need to make sure that dad is not okay. And then they want son to be guardian only to the extent that dad is not okay, right? You know, dad may need help with financial affairs, but not with medical decisions, or it could be the reverse. And so it's an ongoing process. The court is overlooking and overseeing the finances of that person's money. It gets expensive, and planning, you know, the cheapest thing that we do is a healthcare proxy and a power of attorney. And they end up being the most important things that you could possibly do, not just because of avoiding guardianships, but also giving us flexibility to do some pretty heavy-duty Medicaid planning last second, you know, because you already are power of attorney for mom and so on.
Yes, that's right. And we don't want to have to make our money doing guardianships. You know, we really want to do what's best for you and easiest for your family. And the power of attorney and the healthcare proxy is the easiest to do.
Jamie, I agree entirely. I view if one of my clients has to go through probate, I take that personally, because that means that, you know, especially when they've done a trust, that means that everything wasn't funded properly or things weren't retitled properly. And, you know, that's why we always want our clients to come in every couple of years. It's not because we make money on it, because we don't. It's just for free consult. Let's just kick the tires and make sure everything still makes sense and that you've followed through with funding the trust or done this or done that, because we're really trying to avoid those awful circumstances where not only did we have a trust, not only did we maybe have long-term care one day, but if we have a probate in addition, goodness, that's I view that as pretty awful.
Right. That means we haven't done our job and going over everything with you. So, and you know, as I said, most of our cases don't go through will contests or guardianships, but we focus on them to show you why you need to do the proper planning in advance.
Have a great weekend, everyone.
Enjoy your weekend. I'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.